Next speaker is Dr. Sanjay Parikh, and his talk is the sorption of metals and organic contaminants to biochar.
Great. Thank you. All right, thanks everyone for being here today, and I have to start my talk off with an apology in that unfortunately I'm chairing a session in S2 right now, so I need to give my talk and leave, but my postdoc, Dr. Mpungai Mokome is here, and he can talk to you later during the breaks, and he's also giving a talk later, and I'll try to come by afterwards. Okay, so today, it's biochar, and we know biochar can be made from the pyrolysis of waste biomass, and as it was pointed out very nicely in the previous talk, that there's benefits of using these waste materials for both biochar production as an intentional soil amendment, or also for it can be produced as a byproduct of bioenergy. So depending on what our goal is, the biochar properties will be different. But the question that we have is that we're going to have this material, whether we're making intentionally as a soil amendment or it's a waste product, so to speak, from bioenergy. The material will be there, and so it's important to realize what we could use it for, what benefits could it afford to us. And when it's put in the soil amendment, there's all types of reactions that can take place. And, you know, it's been proposed and shown in many cases that we can alter greenhouse gas emissions and that when the biochar is in the soil, we're going to have certain interactions which occur between the biochar and the soil minerals, which can lead to the stabilization of the biochar, or perhaps even influencing the sort of, we'll call it, native soil carbon and nitrogen cycles, so the sort of dissolved organic carbon present in soils. And so what we've been doing is looking at various types of benefits that can be received across the board in an agroecosystem. And so today I'm going to talk a little bit about the native carbon and nitrogen, and also in addition to that, what capacity does biochar have for binding organic contaminants, and today those are pharmaceuticals and heavy metals. So we've been working with about 12 biochars, and today I'm presenting data on the three that we've done the most work with: a walnut shell biochar, which is produced at 900 degrees C, and two woodstock biochars, which are produced at 410 and 510. When we look at, and then also I'll be using activated carbon throughout the talk for much of the data as a control for something that we know is a very good sorbent, high absorption capacity. And when we look at the properties, a range of properties for these, we see the interesting thing is this walnut bioshell, which has a very high ash content compared to the others, and still a decent amount of carbon, 55% carbon. And in going with that high ash content, we end up with a little more iron and potassium present as well. The hydrogen-carbon ratio is relatively low. It's not as low as the activated carbon, but it is lower than the other wood biochars, which is indicative of likely greater aromaticity in that sample. CEC is comparable to activated carbon, but the surface area is much less than activated carbon on the lines of those, well, at least the higher temperature wood biochar. So I just want to go through and give sort of a bunch of flashpoints of different things we've been doing with this, these materials, and sort of see, you know, where we can get our most bang for our buck by using biochar and looking at different scenarios. So one thing is, this is data given by collaborators of ours, Emma Suttick and Johan Six, where they did a field plot trial with a rotation of lettuce and legumes, and they measured N2O emissions. And when we look at the control over here and with a compost treatment, the N2O emissions are approximately the same, maybe a little bit reduction when the compost is there. But in general, we're not getting a great reduction in N2O in this system when it's applied 10 tons per hectare on a YOLO silt loam. Similar things were observed in our batch incubation studies. Here we have data for the three biochars that I've mentioned with the same soil as the field, the YOLO silt loam. And when we just, if we look at the CO2 emissions, and we can focus right now on the yellow bars without the acetylene, and we see that when we have the soil plus compost or the soil plus compost and biochar, so there isn't much difference in the CO2 emissions. So we're not getting a benefit from the biochar in this case. And N2O emissions without acetylene, there's the gray bars, and same thing. We're not really altering the emissions in this case. With the acetylene, where we're preventing complete denitrification, there seems to be a little bit of a benefit, most likely microbial-driven processes. But here, you know, it's certainly not going to be a bad thing. In this case, it's not increasing our greenhouse gas emissions, and so there's some benefit. But what else can biochar provide for us? And it's certainly been proposed that biochar will be good for carbon sequestration. And obviously, the biochar itself is, you know, sequestering carbon. And that's a mid-term strategy to long-term, depending. But I was wondering, what effect can it have on the native carbon? Is there a way that we can add it to particularly sandy soils, which are known to be hard to get an accumulation of soil organic matter? Where the DOC is often leached through. So if we add biochar to the soil, does it work as a way that we can prime the system, and then we would reduce leaching of carbon, nitrogen, and lead to an increased retention and building up of soil organic matter? So as a first step towards answering that question, we just wanted to know, do these materials bind significant amounts of carbon? Would they prevent leaching? And so using a compost extract, just a water extract, to get the dissolved organic carbon nitrogen, and doing sorption experiments, these are just batch sorption experiments, we see that for both carbon and nitrogen, the walnut in red and the activated carbon in the blue triangles both bind considerable amounts of carbon and nitrogen. So there is this affinity, not very surprising, but there is this affinity, and they will start to pull that stuff out, presumably in soil, reducing leaching. When we compare that to these wood biochars at the 410, 510, they don't bind nearly as much, so they're not going to be as effective at reducing leaching. One thing that's really interesting here is this maroon star, the low-temperature biochar, or the 410, and you see that the initial points are way out here at 125 or so milligrams carbon per liter. That wasn't our lowest concentration. In fact, when we did the pre-equilibration with the water phase for 48 hours, it was actually breaking down and releasing carbon to the water. So the biochar sequestration in this case for this 410 was not a very it's not a very stable product. So it was actually releasing carbon instead of serving as a sink. All right, so what parts of the carbon are being taken up is also an important question. And we can get at this by doing a SUVA analysis, which is the specific absorbance, UV absorbance at 254, which gives us an indication of the aromaticity of the carbon. And the way I plotted it was SUVA final over SUVA initial. So any ratio that falls below 1 is indicative of less aromatic carbon remaining. So, and when we look at this, all the points pretty much fall below that ratio of 1, meaning that all the materials we're looking at are favoring sorption of the aromatic fraction. And in particular, we have the star of the show, the walnut biochar, which is always a standout, is greatly favoring the absorption of the aromatic fraction. So I think this shows here initially that there's certainly some promise of different biochars in being able to reduce the leaching of the sort of native carbon in soils that's typically lost. Now, moving on to we're talking about aromatics in soils and how there's this favorable sorption of the aromatic fraction. And that gets me thinking about how it might interact with contaminants and organic contaminants, many of which are highly aromatic. And so, for example, these pharmaceuticals here, which are commonly present in biosolids, and so we have ciprofloxacin, triclocarban, and triclosan, all of these compounds are in biosolids and therefore would limit the potential use of biosolids. We don't want to be putting this in our soils. Along in biosolids, we also have some heavy metals, which You know, it's not good to have those in terms of crops if they're going to accumulate. So a question is, so maybe biochar can have another potential use. Maybe it can be used to reduce the fate, transport, and bioavailability of toxic compounds that would be present in biosolids or perhaps present in animal manures from dairies, poultry, swine operations, which also can have higher levels of different pharmaceuticals. So we have some sorption data here for these three pharmaceuticals on the 510 wood biochar. And we see that the sorption is very different, with the Cipro being the lowest and the TCC being the highest. And this is predicted based on the log KLW. So the TCC with the highest log KLW binds to the greatest extent. Cipro, the lowest, binds the least. But now, my favorite biochar, as you're starting to realize, is this walnut biochar, right? It seems to have a lot of interesting properties. And so what happens when we react it with the walnut biochar? It has a very high sorption capacity for these organic compounds. So carbon, nitrogen, now these organics. In fact, it takes all of the Cipro out of solution. It's basically the same as the activated carbon. And so certainly addition of this would reduce transport and presumably bioavailability. Now, with the biosolids, we're also introducing metals. And so the metal transport, is it reduced? And when we look at the results here, the walnut shell biochar and activated carbon and the wood at 510, we see that the walnut shell does a really good job, very high affinity for the cadmium, lead, and copper, and a little bit less for the nickel. The activated carbon is very similar, except it doesn't bind quite as much cadmium as the walnut shell biochar, likely due to the difference between the two being the high ash content of the walnut shell biochar. And then the wood biochar binds the least metals, and in fact it only binds copper. Most of the other metals are not removed from solution in this case. So the walnut shell biochar, and just like a lot of nutshell biochars that are produced, they end up having this higher ash content. And during the pyrolysis, at these high temperatures, like at 900 degrees, we end up with some amorphous metal oxides that could be present. And so we have these different types of surfaces, as opposed to the ones with the lower ash content, which are really just organic surfaces. So now we get a variety of different surfaces and sites for binding. So we're introducing both like a metal oxide surface where we can have sorption of the metals or organics to those surfaces, perhaps pH dependent, it's very likely. And then in addition to that, we have these biochars. The biochars having all kinds of surfaces, external surfaces, micropores, macropores, all of which particles could become trapped in, bind to it. The biochar material, as we know, is a lot of these sheets of aromatic rings, so it has a lot of hydrophobicity. And in addition to that, present are some carboxyl, hydroxyl groups, all of which would be favorable binding sites for metals, for example. And so we have many, many sites here on the biochar, on the carbon part of this biochar, for sorption to occur. And so what I've done is sort of gone through and thrown a lot of stuff out there and just sort of demonstrating that I think that, you know, biochar is going to be here to stay, that bioenergy production is going to increase, and that finding the best possible home for it is going to be very important. And I would propose that places where we have fertigation of dairy manures or application of biosolids where we want to improve soil quality, reduce the leaching of nutrients, increase carbon storage. And at the same time, we're concerned about contaminants, that this type of scenario could provide some of the best services to an agroecosystem. And so potentially, maybe we can, you know, not just go for carbon sequestration or greenhouse gases, but find scenarios where we can produce a biochar local to a site and apply it so that we get a variety of benefits. And so even if one of these, each benefit is just a little bit, they'll add up to be a highly beneficial situation. So with that, just want to thank people in the lab. Everyone here in red did at least some of the data collection. and then also thank the funding agencies. So, thank you.
Analysis, which is a rough approximation, certainly shows that, particularly that walnut shell, and at low concentrations for all of them, the first parts of the carbon that were removed were aromatic.
And did you have a rationale or a proposed mechanism for why that happened?
We don't really know, but I just sort of believe that the aromatic sites, the hydrophobic sites on the biochar, are the first things that, you know, they're dominating the surface, so they take it up, and then later on, I don't know if there's multi-layers of binding occurring, but I'm not really sure. And the activated carbon one was very interesting because it sort of, as you increase concentration, it was having less preference for aromatic, and then at some point, it came back down to having a greater mechanism, and I've really been puzzled why that would be the case.
Yeah. I've got two questions.
First
one very short. Is that correct that you said that there are 4 to 5 grams of DOCs more per gram of biochar? Because that's what it looked like on the axis. Is that?
It might be. I maybe there's a mistake there. I can check, but I'm not sure off the top of my head of the value.
Okay. And then my other question was the pharmaceuticals you look at. If I saw quickly enough. And there's something like 6 orders of magnitude difference in the KOWs, yet the difference at some given equilibrium concentration was maybe a factor of 5. So the, and there's no comparison between the KOW hydrophobicity of these compounds and the actual absorption on those charts. It's not
They are extremely different, and we chose those for that reason. We wanted to have highly different KOWs.
It looks like KOW is simply not a major. Hydrophobicity is not what's defining the absorption capacity of the star, but at least that's what it looks like.
That could be correct. I'll have to revisit that. Thanks for the point.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.